Welcome to Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Thursday, April 28, 2022. I'm Ash Bennington, joined today by Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer of Bleakley Advisory Group. Peter, welcome.
Thank you, Ash, for having me.
Peter, obviously an incredibly busy day in markets and macro today. Looking out here, it looks like the NASDAQ is up over 3% on the day, closing down here at 12,871. Everything up, lots of green on the screen. S&P 500 up about 2.5%, closing out at around 4,287. And Dow Jones, also industrial average, also up 1.85%. Peter, a lot happening, lots of moving parts. What's your big picture? How are you thinking about this at the 50,000-foot level?
Well, I went to sleep Monday night, and I just woke up, and the S&P is at the same level. So I'm wondering if there's anything going on. I think the market is right now trying to get through earnings and not just seeing what companies are doing relative to the expectations embedded in the stocks, but also trying to figure out where is the U.S. economy, where is the global economy from here. And I think that the level of unknowns is why we're seeing such huge moves. On top of course, this monetary and interest rate noose that is slowly tightening around everything. Now, of course, going into today with the Facebook move, obviously expectations were very low going into the print. The stock was trading at 13 times earnings going in, so there was room for a readjustment higher. But I think all in all, it's just really churn, and it's churn with lower highs and the market trying to hold its stance against the February and March lows. My sense of earnings so far, to tie it into this what's going on this week and the week before, after listening to a lot of conference calls and reading through transcripts, is, obviously there's a lot of fear out there about the economy and everything, and consumer confidence is and multi-decade lows, or actually probably back to where we were in 2009, but from what I'm hearing from companies is that the U.S. consumer, notwithstanding the inflation pressures and all the worries, it's still hanging in there. But the question is for how much longer can it? And if you look at a big ticket item like selling cars, Ford and GM said that there's very little demand destruction seen from historically high prices and now rising funding costs. But you listen to the CEO of Coca-Cola, who is selling a product that costs $1. Maybe if you buy Powerade or one of the other drinks, it costs you $2 or $3. So we're not talking about big ticket items here. And he's wondering whether we're now pushing up against the limits of how much they can raise prices without hurting demand. Getting into this whole debate about elasticity when it comes to products. And I do think we're getting close to bumping up against it. And it's interesting when you look at also—
But there's this idea of bumping up against the limit of pricing power with what we're seeing right now with inflation and with consumers able to deal with that capacity.
Right. And I do think we're now just beginning to test it. And I'm listening to CEOs, they're still okay with today. They're still okay with how the first quarter went in terms of demand and even the first month of Q2. And they're obviously hoping that that continues, but there's definitely acknowledgement that we're unsure how much it can continue. I also read the Meritage Homes to get into the housing industry, since that's also a big focus here, particularly with the sharp rise in mortgage rates and record high prices. Their business in Q1 was good, solid demand. But they're even acknowledging that it's unsustainable. You can't have 20% home price gains and now mortgage rates that are up 150 basis points in a short period of time and expect that business just to continue. If you look at the last couple of weeks, we got regional manufacturing surveys from New York, Richmond, Philly, and Dallas, April was okay. But the six-month business outlook fell sharply. And I think it was New York that fell to the lowest level since March 2020. So there is definite hesitancy about what is to come, even though CEOs today haven't necessarily seen it yet.
Yeah. So much to unpack there. By the way, you mentioned Facebook Meta Platforms up on the day, 17.6%, closing around 205 off fractionally here in after hours trading. Peter, I started my day today earlier reading the book report with Peter Bookvar, where you unpack some of the data that we got from GDP, from the BEA report out this morning. Obviously, an interesting report, things moving in every direction, it seemed. Overall aggregate contraction, 1.5% quarter over quarter, after being up almost 7%, 6.9 in Q4 21. The estimate was for a 1% increase. Obviously, we didn't get that. And yet, strong consumer demand. Talk to us a little bit about this paradox and what it means. You also point out in the report the GDP deflator impact in addition to trade imbalance.
Right. So the perspective for Q1 was a 6.9% increase in Q4. And so that was the tough comparison that we ran up against, where inventories in Q4 added, I think it was 530 basis points of the 690. So in Q1, we had some reversal on the inventory side. So inventories were a drag, but the biggest drag was trade. And the very large trade deficit with imports rising much faster than exports, right, took off over 300 basis points from the GDP figure. And the tip off to that was yesterday when we saw trade deficit for goods that was expected to be $105 billion came in at $125 billion, a fresh record high. And we can also tie that into the dollar, considering what's going on with the dollar here, right, after this. But as you said, the consumer and capital spending is what kept Q1 from being worse. And in terms of the deflator, right, that took off 0.8. Because the expectations were for a price deflator of 7.2, came in at 8%. So if the deflator was in line, that contraction would have been 0.6 instead of 1.4. And also government spending took off a little bit. So the question is, okay, what happens with Q2? Right. And I do think trade will still be a drag. I think we can definitely debate and understand the possibility that China is going to see negative growth in Q2, second biggest economy. Europe is very possibly in a recession in the second quarter. And so the trade side should be a drag. Capital spending could be okay again, and consumer spending should still be a positive. So we should see a positive number in front of Q2 GDP. But I think Q3, Q4, the risks are rising that we start to see negative numbers again. And that really is the bottom line with the U.S. economy is, and getting to what we talked about in the beginning, is we're approaching the breaking point of the consumer saying no mas with, right, these price increases relative to my wage gains. Hasn't happened yet, but I think we're progressing towards that breaking point. And it may not happen in Q2, but Q3 I think is very likely.
The $10 trillion question here, how will we know when we begin to cross that threshold? What will be the early warning signs that are going to flash on the dashboard that will give us this sense that we won't be able to see this continued growth with consumers getting priced out of markets?
Well, I'll take you back to 2008, when the economy started to roll over. Everyone started getting worried about Bear going under and Lehman going under.
Yeah.
And then Pepsi said, we're seeing a slowdown in sales. And they're selling, you know, getting back to Coke, potato chips, Doritos, and soft drinks. And if that low price ticket item starts to get impacted by consumer spending, then you know we have a bigger problem. So, yeah, as I mentioned, Coke feels like we're getting close to the limits at which consumers will accept further price increases, even though we're not there yet. If all of a sudden you start to see the trade downs from some of these brands to more to private label, then we should start to worry, because global trade That's going to contract again. Capital spending, well, it'll hold up as long as cash flows hold up.
Right.
And that's an important thing, too, because big companies, they can continue on with their capital spending plans because they're more insulated from a cash flow perspective. But small, medium-sized businesses are seeing crimson cash flow. They're seeing falls in profit margins. So I don't know how much longer we can go at these capital spending levels. But it still comes down to the consumer. That's most of the U.S. economy.
Right.
And it'll come down to housing and autos, with those being the two most interest rate-sensitive big-ticket items out there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's about 70% of GDP is consumer expenditures. You know, it's interesting, and this is why it's so great to have you here on a day like today, Peter. You mentioned 2007, the Bear Stearns hedge fund collapse. I remember that period. There were folks kind of shrugged it off, like, why do I care with it, whether the Bear Stearns high-grade structured credit enhanced leveraged fund, that was actually what it was called, collapsed. There was a sort of collective shrug. It seemed immaterial, and then it starts to filter in. Precisely as you say, when it's Coke and Doritos. I think such a powerful metaphor for this question of where we sit right now.
I think we're headed towards the recession, and that's not really that profound because, well, when the Fed tightens monetary policy, that's where we usually end up. You know, a soft landing is a rare occurrence, and I think right now is a pipe dream. I mean, we are on the cusp of experiencing the most aggressive monetary tightening in the post-Volcker world.
Right.
Where we may see 3 to 4 meetings in a row of 50 basis point increases. Now, the last time the Fed raised 50 basis points was in, I think it was 2000, when they raised the Fed funds rate from 6 to 6.5. And then back in 1994, I think Greenspan raised 75 basis points at one meeting. But those were sort of one-offs. And yeah, the Fed funds rate went from 3 to 6 in a short period of time in 94. That was the soft landing. But now you have this kind of tightening priced in. Now, it's been priced in already. But then quantitative tightening, where was going from 0 to 95 in 3 months. When they started the last one in October 2017, it started at a $10 billion a month and went from basically 0 to 50 over a 12-month time frame. So this is what I'm referring to, and I did also in 2018, double-barreled tightening in right. a very aggressive way. And there is no chance that with that we see a soft landing. So yeah, the short end of the yield curve, we priced in those rate hikes. What we have not priced in yet is the economic impact of all this. We have yet, I haven't seen S&P earnings estimates fall one penny for this year. I'm assuming we're going to go into a recession, and there's zero chance we're going to realize those earnings numbers. I don't think that earnings estimates really reflect what will be a European recession driven by the spike in energy prices. I don't think we've really modeled in this China slowdown, even though I don't think that these shutdowns will last longer than the next month because it's just humanly unsustainable. So I think that there's a lot to price in terms of the economic impact of the sharp rise in interest rates and global monetary tightening, and on top of, obviously, in response to this inflation story that is going to begin to bite the consumer.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, by the way, Peter, I'm looking here as we have this show at the streaming comments in YouTube. I'm seeing this comment coming from, is this it? Amazon misses earnings estimate by 11%. I'm looking on the Bloomberg terminal. We should probably take a look here and see what's happening right now with Amazon earnings. Boy, there's some interesting things that are coming out. Worldwide shipping costs jumped 14%. Over at Amazon this quarter. I mean, this is pretty significant. Any thoughts on this? I know it's a breaking story. I know we're kind of having to play from audibles off the screen as we cover this. But what are your thoughts on what's happening over Q1 22 earnings at Amazon?
So without even reading the release, we know, okay, let's separate out the two businesses, retail and the AWS. AWS, I'm sure, was fine. But the retail business is a very competitive, low-margin business.
Yeah.
And Amazon, as much as any company, is subject to rising wage costs and accelerating transportation costs and all the supply chain problems. Amazon is smack in the middle. So I have to believe those challenges explains why they missed as badly as they did. And I'll have to see what they say with AWS. With respect to Apple, which I think they report at 4:30, well, what are they going to say about their business in China? What are they going to say about their business in Europe? I mean, if all of a sudden you're a European consumer and your energy bills just went through the roof, maybe you'll hold on to your current iPhone for a few extra months or quarters. And what are they going to say about the supply chain? They're not immune. I mean, what we learned with Google and what they said about YouTube and those numbers missing, and particularly citing a slowdown in Europe, these companies are part of the global economy. They're not immune to what's going on. And you can be sure there's been a lot of money that's hiding in them, thinking that they are, but they're not. And now they're finally getting around to them.
Yeah, very well said. Peter, what does it all mean, big picture, as we talk about this and we try to digest these earnings? How do you effectively process this new information relative to the big picture thesis that you have on markets?
I think look at the progression of events. And it all starts with a change in monetary policy. So the meme stock craze peaked in February 2021. That was the height of euphoria. And it's no coincidence that 4 months later, Jay Powell said, we're now thinking about tapering QE. And that was the first step away from the extreme easy monetary policy that started in March 2020. And it is no coincidence that the market started to chip away at all those high-flying stocks. Because when the monetary tide changes, valuations all of a sudden matter. So through the end of last year, they clipped all those high flyers in a valuation rethink. In conjunction with a rate adjustment, we saw, obviously, rates rise last year. And then this year, when people realized that inflation is not transitory, we had a further rate adjustment, and then, of course, that valuation rethink began to spread. Now it's what is the economic impact of that, and that is what is to come. And like I said, that is what is not yet priced in or only beginning to get priced in. I mean, if you look at auto stocks, GM and Ford, if you look at Home Depot, you look at the home builders, yeah, they've corrected already. They've already begun the adjustment process for this sharp rise in interest rates. They've already repriced. Now, whether the repricing still has further to go, yeah, probably does, but it's already, a lot of repricing has already taken place. But there's still hopes and wishes that somehow everything is going to be fine and we're going to be able to weather not just this inflation move, but this interest rate move. But it's just not possible. We are a credit-dependent economy, and I've said this a million times. We have credit cycles that ebb and flow with the cost of capital. You cannot not slow down when the cost of capital rises, particularly as sharp as it has.
You know, Peter, I'm glad you mentioned credit and credit cycles. I wanted to take a moment here to take a look at a clip about U.S. Treasuries. This actually is out today on the Real Vision platform for Essential Plus and Pro subscribers here at Real Vision. And the host is Harry Melandri, hosting Jens Nordvig of Ex-Ante Data. Let's take a look at this clip.
There is a big constituency in the institutional fixed income management that I think have a hard time essentially de-learning this notion that you never get inflation, right?
And yeah, that is such a good point. We have evolutionary deselected. Same as we have, there are no JGB bears left. They were all deselected by nature.
Yeah.
In the same way, there are no G7 real money manager bears. It's just not, if you were, you were deselected and sacked years ago.
Yep. Yeah.
So
I think that's still the reason why it's hard to get bond yields above 3, right? Even though you say, okay, if you look at this and you know you can get easily 5% surprise on inflation above target, and then the bond yield is still 3. I think that has to do with that bid still being there. And the more persistent, I know it's become like a kind of no-no to talk about transitory and persistent, but
no, not at all.
The longer it's going to last here, this year and into next year, that we have this inflationary pressure and overshooting relative to target, we're going to have essentially, we used to talk about inflation premium in the bond market, right? And now we've had a couple of years where you could read academic papers about a negative inflation premium bond market. Like, given that asymmetry I just alluded to, I think that's going to be repriced going forward.
That's Jens Nordvig and Harry Melandri. By the way, if you're watching on YouTube, these are the kinds of conversations we'd love to have you join us for on the Real Vision platform. Talking of the conversation, Peter, thoughts about U.S. Treasuries and how it ties in with the credit cycle?
Well, it's really interesting moment for U.S. Treasuries, not only because of the inflation and growth situation where, on one hand, you got the Treasury bulls because they see a recession coming and you got to buy long-term Treasuries, but still this inflation story that is remaining, I believe, very sticky and still running well above nominal rates. But you also have the dynamic of where European bond yields go from here and where they've already gone as an influence on U.S. Treasuries, and also, of course, the direction of GGBs, where they haven't gone much yet in terms of movements because the BOJ has got its foot on the neck of GGB yields, but something that we have to pay attention to. In addition to the Fed walking away to the tune of $95 billion a month, at the same time, foreigners have been reducing their percentage ownership of U.S. Treasuries, and we will soon see whether that is going to be accelerated post the sanctioning of the Bank of Russia. So I've said for a while that you can't just analyze U.S. growth and inflation and try to figure out where U.S. yields are going to go on the long end. The short end, I think, have priced in these rate hikes. The longer end, there's a lot more going on. Where the German 10-year bund yield goes will have a big influence on U.S. Treasuries. Whether the BOJ finally throws in the towel on yield curve control or at least widens the band because the Ministry of Finance and the Kishida government can't handle further yen weakness will have a big influence on where long-end treasuries go. So, people tell me, oh, we're going to go into recession by long-term treasuries. I'm like, you got to broaden your analysis here. There's a lot more of going on here that needs to be part of this conversation when it comes to trying to figure out where the 10-year yield is going.
Yeah, by the way, talking of BOJ, something we haven't yet touched on, dollar yen, USD JPY spiking here on the day over 130, yen weakness 10-year lows.
20-year lows. It's really just fascinating and bizarre what's going on with Japan. So, today's Thursday. On Wednesday, you had the Prime Minister of Japan saying, I am supportive of the BOJ's attempt to get to 2% inflation. At the same time, he and his Minister of Finance, Suzuki, is saying, we need to be really careful and we need to avoid these sharp moves in the yen. And he also, Kishida said, at the same time, he says, we need 2% inflation, said, we need to be really careful that we don't have these sharp rises in energy and other inflationary pressures that could hurt the consumer.
Is that a contradiction or a paradox?
Yeah, that's a good question. And then you have Kuroda, who keeps pushing the pedal for 2% inflation, and then says that he doesn't like these short moves in the yen. So there is just this bizarre situation going on where they've reached a point you either accept further yen weakness, possibly to 150, if you still want the Bank of Japan to maintain yield curve control, or he widens that band, and then we have a potential major earthquake through the world's bond markets if he does, but then he can at least stem the rise in the yen and control the spike in imported inflation, particularly energy. And we are reaching towards this fork in the road, probably at that fork in the road, as the BOJ and the Minister of Finance go to loggerheads here. And now, the BOJ is 10 years into this, we want 2% inflation. It's not like they just started to try. So Kuroda, if he was in the private sector, would have been fired many years ago. But because he's a government bureaucrat, you know, their response is, if what you're doing doesn't work, just keep doing more of it.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Peter, I want to hit some questions. I know we don't have a ton of time here, but let's do a quick speed round to get in some of these questions from Real Vision subscribers and viewers. The first one comes to us from Jazz. This is from the Real Vision site. Companies are going up on weak quarters and guidance is a signal of what exactly?
Well, that earnings story is going to start to falter, and that Q4 was probably peak profit margins. Q1, we're seeing a bit of a reduction, and that profit margin squeeze is going to continue as the year progresses. It'll mostly be felt initially with small, medium-sized businesses. Bigger companies, at least right now, will be able to maintain as much as they can. And I think also gets into the broader inflation story, because companies that have had a squeeze in margins up to this point are going to still try to recapture those lost margins as the year progresses. You take Kimberly-Clark, for example, and I've used them as an example before, is that when you see a very sharp increase in your cost structure, whether that's labor, shipping, raw materials, packaging, you can't pass that on to the consumer all at once. You have to absorb a lot of it and sort of recapture it over time so you don't shock the consumer. You don't call up Walmart and say, my cost just went up 30%, and I'm raising the cost of tissues, diapers, and toilet paper by 30%. No, you spread that out over time to recapture those lost margins. But there's going to be a margin hit, and we'll see how much the consumer is willing to tolerate you as a company trying to recapture that lost margin on the back of me. So I do expect that this earnings story is going to start to get impacted. You'll see slower revenue growth for those businesses that do business in Europe, certainly in Asia because of China. And anything that's consumer related that hasn't gotten a hit yet, I have to believe it will at some point in Q2 or Q3 or Q4.
We're going to run a few extra minutes here. Obviously, lots to cover, lots happening right now. Do we want to do a real-time dissection here on Amazon? What do you think?
So, like I said, they're in the retail business. That means they're subject to inflationary pressures, labor cost pressures, and transportation cost pressures. It's Amazon, but they're still in the retail business. And they pretty much cited that. And I see a headline, working through inflationary and supply chain pressures. So they're a retailer subject to the same thing that everybody else is in that business. Looks like the AWS business did beat, which is not surprising considering what Microsoft said. But retail is a competitive, lower margin business. And Amazon just reminded everybody of that.
It looks like it's basically a hit on revenue. It looks like 116.44 billion versus 116.3 billion expected. So basically on target, a slight beat there on the revenue top line number.
And then next, we'll see what Apple has to say. And obviously, most relevant will be their China business and their product sourcing and availability will be obviously in question. And what they have to say about the European consumer, that will be interesting since they obviously do huge business there as well.
Yeah, what are your thoughts about what's happening in Europe? We actually had a question coming to us from Ralph Humphrey about what was happening in Europe, the relative positioning and strength of European economies. What are you thinking about in Europe right now?
Well, let's take natural gas prices. If you you equate it on an equal basis to where how the U.S. prices it, it's trading at about $30 per million BTU. Where U.S. natural gas prices are, call it, around six-ish. So they're paying about five times higher natural gas prices on top of much higher gasoline prices, which they always do because of taxes, but even more so now. So Europe is going to be in a recession. I see Apple blew away the revenue number. I didn't see their EPS number. We'll see the breakdown of that and how much was pulled forward, but that should be interesting. So it's... I'm concerned about Europe. I mean, and also the monetary tightening that has happened in terms of the markets adjustment and what's to come with. I mean, the ECB is still doing QE. That's going to end in a couple months, but they're still doing QE. And but they may actually get out of negative interest rates by year end.
Yeah, 2Q revenue, Apple. It just flipped on my screen here. We're literally getting these as news flashes, but it looks like a beat.
Yeah, and we're curious to see what the guidance is.
Yeah. While we're waiting for that, let me just hit a question here. This one comes to us from Tim Long Island from the Real Vision website. And the question is, thoughts on the HYG, this is high-grade junk bond market, where we can see this drop coming in recent days. Let me just paraphrase this question to simplify it. What are your thoughts on what's happening in high yield right now?
So no doubt in corporate credit that should be the biggest focus and the biggest concern. And yeah. Something that I am also watching closely every single day, particularly the triple C category of high yield. Now, HYG has definitely softened.
This is the iShares Box High Yield Corporate Bond ETF.
Right. And what's keeping it actually from softening some more is it actually has energy companies in there that have done well. But if you look at just the broader triple C category of high yield, since that is the lowest rung of high yield before you get to D for default, the yield, or call it the cost of capital, is now at 10%, which is the highest level we've seen in a few years, and its spread to treasuries has widened out. Amazingly, though, it hasn't widened out that much to where it was pre-COVID, so that tells me that there's a lot more weakness to come. And I think the reason why it hasn't weakened further is because there's still the belief that the U.S. economy can weather what is going on. But I do expect breakage there as growth slows. But it's an important thing that people should be watching every single day to sort of gauge the market's perception of where growth will be in Q2, Q3.
Hey, Peter, some Apple numbers coming to me from our producer, Brian, right now. Let me just read them to you off the screen. You tell me what you think. EPS, this is earnings per share, $1.52 versus $1.43 estimate. Obviously, that's a beat. Revenue, $97.3 billion or thereabouts versus $93.9 billion estimated, up 8.6% roughly year over year. Thoughts?
Well, I would have actually, with that revenue beat of $4 billion plus, I would have thought that maybe EPS would have beaten more. So I want to see what their gross margin was quarter over quarter. But even with Apple, you talked about 8% revenue growth. It's a stock that's trading at 27 times earnings. 27 times is expensive for a company that is only seeing modest growth, particularly EPS growth. And again, we'll see what guidance is in terms of their China business, see what they say about the U.S. consumer and the European consumer, as I mentioned. And you know, at the end of the day, it's still an iPhone company, even though they're obviously growing out their services business and some other. And
hey, Peter, to that point, let me read you these numbers because these are really interesting. iPhone revenue, $50.57 billion versus $47.88 billion estimate. It's a beat, up 5.5% year on year. This is the number that really jumped out at me, precisely to your point. Services revenue, 19.82 billion versus 19.72 billion estimate. But here's the really interesting part. On a year over year basis, up 17.28%, these numbers per CNBC. Peter, thoughts? Impressive year-over-year performance on services revenue.
Yeah, that's where their growth is. I mean, cell phones, as you said, is only up 5%. I mean, the cell phone industry, the smartphone industry is just a replacement business right now. It's almost like the TV set business. You know, you replace a TV every bunch of years because maybe there's a slight change. That's reached a point where incremental changes aren't that much. And that essentially is what the smartphone industry is right now. And that's why you're only seeing modest growth for that. But yeah, the services business and other areas like wearables will see the faster growth. I'm curious to see what their PC business is because we had a lot of pull forward of PC sales over the last couple of years as more people work from home.
Peter, I can give it to you right now. It's Mac revenue, 10.44 billion versus 9.25 billion estimate, up 14.73% year over year. Peter,
yeah, I mean that's an impressive quarter.
Yeah,
I just wonder how much is left, considering how much people have spent on their PCs over the last and laptops to work from home over the last couple of years.
Looks like after hours trading up about 2.32% last trade on my screen, 167.43 on Apple. Obviously, great day to be here talking about this with you. So much happening. As we come to the conclusion of this conversation, Peter, final thoughts, key takeaways, obviously a rich conversation. How do you distill it? How do you break it down?
I think this challenging investing environment is going to be with us. But there are a few things that we're gleaning. Value stocks are outperforming growth as investors are much more valuation sensitive, and I expect that to continue. We've had a little pullback here in commodities, but I would be buying on them on pullbacks, particularly energy and the metals, the uranium stocks, the ag stocks. I keep a close eye on. I was long fertilizers for a while, but recently trimmed them. But I think we're going to be surprised at where commodity prices go because the supply side is so crimped, even if we get this faltering demand. And I just think that humility is going to be a very important part of one's investing process. Now, it always should be, but even more so now as people are losing money in both stocks and in bonds. So just losing less is an achievement right now in this market. And I think people should just rein in their risk tolerance.
Yeah, very well said, very elegantly framed and summed up. Peter, always a pleasure to have you with us, but especially great to have you today. Obviously, so much happening. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ash. Always fun, and I enjoy the conversation.
Thanks again for watching Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'll be back tomorrow with Raul. That's right, CEO Raul Pal and I will have our Real Vision Daily Briefing Friday conversation tomorrow. In the meantime, go check out Real Vision's newest podcast, The Next Big Trade with Harry Melandri. On tomorrow's new episode, renowned trader and climate activist Ross Gerber joins Harry to break down Tesla. Enjoy the show. Thank you so much.
Welcome to The Next Big Trade. On this program, I'll talk to some of the world's foremost traders about current trends in markets and what they believe is a smart bet.
My next big trade is Tesla, and Tesla being the king of the climate change impactful companies that an investor can invest in and think about over the next decade what they will hopefully accomplish will be monumental and probably even be bigger than what Apple has accomplished.
Yeah, my forecasts are not going to change whether the Green Deal gets approved or doesn't get approved. If you don't have a planet, you won't care who invades who. It's completely irrelevant.
The bond market has two jobs. All they need to do is future inflation and future growth. That's it. So when you've got only got two variables to look at, you're most likely that the outcome of the hive mind of bond investors are going to reach the right kind of consensus. I've only seen consensus wrong once in my entire career, and that was 1994, when the bond market blew up. Other than that, the bond consensus has always been right.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.